and the reactant. But you must keep in mind that none of them can tell you what the really what the radiation resistance of the antenna. In other words, it's just giving you a ballpark idea of what your antenna can do. In other words, basically bringing that VSWR down does not make the quality sometimes of the performance, does not control really the performance of the antenna, as I said. So there's a little bit more to it than just understanding VSWR. I hope I put that in the right words, Dick. Go ahead.
WS2N.
All recognized, and you're absolutely right, Mel. There are antennas that have extremely high standing wave ratio, like a 10 to 1. The antenna on a 50-ohm transmission line, the antenna might really represent a 5-ohm impedance. That's a 10 to 1 standing wave ratio, 1/10 of 50 ohm. Or it might be a 500-ohm antenna. The elegant way of measuring what the antenna is doing is with a antenna analyzer of some kind. It could be a network analyzer. A poor man's equivalent is a Berg wattmeter, just measuring forward and reverse power or standing wave ratio. It doesn't tell you exactly what's wrong with the antenna, but it does tell you how good it is. If your Berg wattmeter or your Vis wattmeter is telling you 100 watts is going forward and only 1 watt is coming back, you're in good shape. You don't care what the impedance of the antenna is. All you know is it's running very close to 50 ohms resistive. Correspondingly, if you've got 100 watts going forward and 50 watts coming back, then you know that when you get a chance, you should do something about it. Your motivation for doing that is to make the antenna and transmitter combination work better, because many of our transmitters with a high reflected power go into a self-protect mode, go down to lower power output or self-turning themselves off, and in some cases they produce intermodulation distortion. So in order to get full performance out of your transmitter, you would like it to see a 50-ohm load. Paul, wait for 4 seconds and go ahead with your question. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, I just went through this with the SWR. But I have the meter that does power SWR on the Kenwood 440. And I wanted to get a lighthouse. It was toward the end of that lighthouse weekend that they just had up in Fort Niagara. I got in late on that. I figured, let me at least get one of these guys. But he was on 40 meters. I have an 80-minute dipole up there. And when I put the SWR on it, it was well over 5, you know, closer to 6. I know this rig here, if I go over to 6, it'll shut down. It'll go into self-protect mode. But it was just below that. So I hit the antenna tuner, and that brings it right back. You watch that needle go all the way back down, which looks like 0. I know it's not 0, but it goes all the way back down. And first try, got that guy, no problem. 5 and 9, and, you know, and that was it. So, you know, it's a perfect example of what you were talking about. So I just want to bring that up. That, I mean, I really don't care. If I see the SWR that high, if you hit the antenna tuner button and on the automatic antenna tuners, and it goes, you know, I find you're good to go. I wouldn't be afraid to keep transmitting, Dick. I still 100 watts going out. Back to you, Dick. WS2S.
Yeah, that's a fun story, as I see it, Paul. When you use an 80-meter dipole on 40 meters, if it was a half wavelength on 80 meters, it's now a full wave on 40 meters. A half-wave dipole on its design frequency, in your case probably 3.7 megs, is something close to 73 ohms of resistance and very little ohms of reactance. That same antenna on 40 meters, 7 megacycles, twice the frequency, where it's a full wavelength long. The center impedance is no longer 73 ohms. It's closer to 1,500 ohms. Your true standing wave ratio at the antenna is something close to 20 to 1. In the shack, you saw a 6 to 1 standing wave ratio because of the insertion loss of your feed line and maybe some radiation of the feed line, depending on what balun you're using and so on. So one of the most severe conditions that a lot of guys don't realize, they say, gee, I've got an 80-meter dipole. Let me drop. It's a half wavelength long on 80 meters. It should be re-resonating on 40 meters where it's a full wavelength long. Sounds good. Well, you study the graphs in the antenna books and you realize that's a very severe condition. Go to 3 times the frequency, which I guess is 20 meters, if I got it right. Was that 4 times? No. The 3-to-1 relationship you do have between 40 meters and 21 meters, 40 meters and 15 meters, the 21 megacycle band and the 7 megacycle band, 3-to-1 relationship. On the odd harmonic relationships, the antenna comes back into a fairly nice impedance, but on the even numbers, it doesn't. So that very friendly sounding condition, an 80-meter dipole used on 40 meters, is really a very severe condition. Yes, your antenna tuner took your 6-to-1 that you sent in the shack and corrected it to make the transmitter happy. And if we study exactly what happened in your situation, I'm guessing of the 100 watts that's available to you, something like 40 watts was being radiated. But that's enough. The transmitter was happy. It's giving you full performance and full fidelity because it's seeing a 50-ohm resistor. And for the particular feed line you're using, that antenna tuner had enough range to handle it. If you had an extremely low loss feed line, either because it's something like open wire line or a 3.5-inch hard line cable used on your frequency, then you would have seen a considerably higher standing wave ratio in the shack. Your antenna tuner would have to work quite a bit harder, and there's a slim chance the antenna tuner would have run out of range. Every antenna tuner, by the way, has a certain area of the Smith chart it can cover. And even if your antenna tuner runs out of range, that's not a showstopper. Let me drop. Because most antenna tuners do not cover a perfect circle in the center of the Smith chart. The Smith chart is all possible impedances of your antenna. Common sense would lead you to believe your Smith chart, your antenna tuner will cover a certain amount of area near the center of the chart, and you think it's a circle. It's not. It's a very lopsided-looking, egg-shaped area that it covers. So if you're smart enough to know what's going on, even if you've got an extremely high standing wave ratio antenna where your antenna tuner runs out of range on one of its controls, if you add another length of cable between your antenna tuner and the transmission line, you will be rotating that impedance to a different location on the Smith chart. That's the crazy way the transmission lines work. And you might fall into the good zone of your antenna tuner and be back into its range. So that's something to put in the back of your mind, that running out of range of the antenna tuner is not the last, is not the end of the story. I wonder if you ever heard about that one before, Paul. And by the way, do you have a space report that we should be knowing about? WS2N, K2LIW in the TechNet. Wait 4 seconds.
Okay. Well, yeah, I've heard the story of extending the cable and all, but I'm not going to worry about that. Very few times have I done that. Well, I'll work on 40, mostly CW. I'll do it now and then. But no problem. The space report. One thing I wanted to make, just one comment. They ran another test in Utah on the Ares booster rocket. Not the booster rocket, but the actual launching people into space. NASA still has budget and a contract with Morton Thiokol to keep testing these rockets. Even so, the whole program has been canceled. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens. You do have a lot of congressmen and politicians pushing to revive the Ares and Constellation program. So they just ran a test this week. I did want to mention that, but no, I didn't have much much time for a real space report. I know I'm going to drop this. Let me drop this thing. Okay, I waited for Mike 4 seconds. What we need is another courtesy tone. You want to follow that one. It's like Pavlov dogs here, you know. I hear the courtesy tone, I want to push the button. So we need another tone, a higher pitch or something. Dick, what do you think? Not much from the space world this week. I got the holiday and all, but we'll look further for next Sunday. Back to you, Dick.
Very fine, Paul. Let me wait long enough. Last week on the top 10 stellar book list for New York Times, and probably on there this week, is a very nice book about space called Tacking for Mars by Mary Roach, R-O-A-C-H. I think it's a 2009 or a 2010 book. I'm looking for it right now. Yeah, 2010. Very modern book. And the basic theme of the book is what's required to get an astronaut on Mars. A very popular subject among all of our high school kids these days and college kids. They're all positive that in their generation they're going to see an astronaut standing on Mars. I'm extremely convinced that will not take place within the lifetime of your grandchildren. But that's an opinion. And lots of people disagree with me on that opinion. But you read Mary Roach's book, and as I said, it sounds like she's telling you what's required to get an astronaut on Mars. In a way, she is, but she gives you a lot of inside information about what really goes on with NASA. Let me drop. It turns out there's an awful lot of information behind the scenes that we, as the American public, never hear about. Tremendous amounts of the book are dedicated to what the astronauts really experience. For instance, you've heard me say it before, 50% roughly of all of the astronauts and cosmonauts spend their first 24 hours in space throwing up. 50% of them. It doesn't matter if this is your first mission or your fourth mission. There's a 50-50 chance you're going to be throwing up for the first 24 hours. Call it space sickness if you like. Your body is not acclimated for a zero-G or a microgravity environment, and it responds in that manner. You can take Dramamine if you like. It doesn't cure the problem. It only delays the problem. You won't get the problem right away. You'll get it a day later. You're still going to get the problem. That's just one of the many problems. And when it comes to waste disposal in space, you don't realize it, but every single molecule of gas, liquid, and solid that comes out of a human being is the real process of your metabolism. It goes on continuously. All the energy that allows you to think and move is coming from metabolizing food, and when you're metabolizing food, you're continuously making carbon dioxide, fluid, and solid waste, continuously. And if you listen to her stories about what the astronauts really experience in space while carrying on those bodily functions, wow. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. Call it outhouse humor if you like, but it's not humorous. It's a really nasty problem. I won't go into the details because some of you will be a little bit turned off by it. But if you want to know the inside information as to what the astronauts really experience, you want to read that book. Rather well done. She's a good writer.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
She's a good writer, and she's got a lot of inside information, a lot of friends on the inside of NASA, and the contractors to NASA, who given her information as to what it's really like. Being an astronaut has quite a bit of glamour. There's an awful lot of non-glamour. There's some really basic problems that have only been partially solved. You listen to what the astronauts experience when the toilet on the International Space Station fails, and its many modes of failure, and the degree of difficulty of using it correctly. As I said, quite a bit of the book is disguised, is dedicated to the real inside information that you normally never hear about. And if you want to know what it's like, really like, you want to read that story. And as far as the degree of difficulty of getting an astronaut on Mars, you can tell she's hinting at that, but doesn't get too deep into it, even though the title would suggest that. Now, carry over from last week, we had Rich and 2EO that we didn't get to. And I think Joe, W2RYY, who signed in. And by the way, when we get to you, Joe, your audio is a little bit low. Anything you do to boost your audio would help. So let's go to Rich now. We're going to go to Rich, Joe, and then back to another discussion with Wesley, because I've made some discoveries this week that I would like him to hear about. N2EO, what's going on in Whitestone these days, Rich? And how's Jingles treating you? K2RYW on the tech net.
John was also asking the question.
One comment about that Mars packing story, Dick.
Yeah. Paul first. Go ahead, Paul.
If you go on a computer, one of the YouTube, you put into Google, touring the International Space Station, is, I think it's four different segments. Each one is, maybe 10 minutes long. It's quite long, but I think his name is Finch. He takes you, and it's an astronaut on board the space station. I think it was done last year, maybe about a year and a half ago. And he takes you on a tour going through the space station. And one of the areas he comes to is they haven't put everything away yet. It's all the food and bags of water. And just you can't even see trying to get from one module to the next. It's no room. It's just packed. And it's just a big thing. It's a huge area inside, and it is packed. And he says there's other areas like this. It's just unbelievable. Now, this is just for six people in orbit. You could imagine, I know you've talked about this before, what you would need to bring to Mars. It's absolutely unbelievable. And by the way, they show the urine recycling device. They do recycle. They have a system on that. Eventually, that does become drinking water. But that's maybe one problem solved. But you've got to take this tour on this video. It's incredible. And it's also very good. You really get some education about how big this thing is on the inside deck.
When you took that tour on the International Space Station, you see how tightly it's packed with all of these bags of stuff. Would I be correct in assuming, Paul, that a high percentage of that is consumable products, food, water, oxygen, and whatever, consumable products that must be continuously delivered by Progress ships, something like once every month or so, in order to maintain those astronauts in orbit? Tremendous amounts of materials have to be brought up, which I would consider consumables. So is a high percentage of all of that stuff that's packing that International Space Station consumable material to maintain those astronauts? WS2N, K2RIW in the second hand. Wait for a second.
Yes, it is. He made that point. That's water and food. It's really a problem, and the last Progress ship, when he was there, I think he said it was up like 3 weeks ago, and he still had to put everything away. It's just thousands and thousands of pounds of stuff that come in every time a Progress ship comes up or the shuttle, and they show the Progress ship where they're loading it up with all the debris and garbage. Every 3 months a supply ship comes up with no people in it, and every 3 months a supply ship goes away and they crash it into the burn it up over the Pacific Ocean. Well, the one that's getting burnt up mostly has all this garbage and everything in it. It's just a big problem from what I see in that. And during the tour, there were three astronauts permanently on board. There weren't even six yet. This was right, I think, a couple of months before the six-person crew started there.
We all tend to forget that in 1 year of living, everybody within the sound of my voice is consuming an amount of oxygen, water, and food that has the approximate volume of your house and the approximate weight of your house. That's what it requires to maintain you for 1 year. We take that for granted. Continuously using all of that raw material to maintain all of that metabolism, to make all of that energy production within your body in order to keep that brain working and to keep those muscles moving. A house full, and maybe I'm wrong by 2 to 1, but order of magnitude, it's the volume of your house and the weight of your house per year. And every single one of those molecules that flows through your body, every one of those molecules of gas, fluid, and solid, Mother takes every one of those molecules, doesn't throw any of them away, and in some number of days, hours, years, or whatever, she recycles every one of them for you. And some other person is going to breathe that air, use that fluid, and whatever, at some time downrange. Nothing is wasted. And you've got to recreate all of that on an international space station, on a interplanetary mission like Mars. You must recycle. It's a 3-year mission to Mars and back per person. That would take 3 housefuls worth of stuff in mass and volume. You can't possibly do that. You got to recycle. And that's a level of recycling that we've never done. Someday, maybe. But my goodness, if that recycling machinery ever breaks down during that mission, life gets very complicated very fast. Okay. Let's go over to John. KC2WGB. I hear tell that...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
KC2QIQ with a comment, Dick.
Okay, go with your comment, Glenn.
Just real quickly, it sounds like along with my capacitor that I have to design there for the case of the solar problem, it also sounds like we'll have to add the replicator for the trip to Mars. What do you think about that, Dick? K4IW, KC2QIQ.
It makes great science fiction, and that food replicator they used on Star Trek sounds good, and what it really is a recycler. They didn't make it clear. Where's the raw material coming from? You can't create something out of nothing. That so-called replicator is taking the gaseous, fluid, and solid waste products of those human beings and other animals on board that spaceship and recycling it in some kind of a manner called replicator. You have a finite amount of raw material you put on that ship before you leave Earth. So that's what I think was going on. But that was never made clear for a whole bunch of reasons. But Mother Nature recycles every single molecule. Every breath you take contains air molecules that were once inside the lungs of every single animal and human being that ever walked this planet. It's hard to believe. You go through the mathematics, the laws of probability, it is definitely taking place. A tremendous number of molecules are coming into your lungs in every single breath. And where have all those molecules of air been?
Remember the biosphere in Arizona, Dick?
Yeah, they had great difficulty keeping that thing operational, and as much as they tried, they weren't capable of really being self-sustaining, were they, Paul?
No, they weren't. They had dome after dome, acre after acre, huge space for only 6 people, and they couldn't do it. I mean, they had gardens and, you know, everything you would envision that you could shoot up into space. You know, it was so huge. I mean, it would have. The area itself was probably as big as the whole space station, you know, what you're looking at, you know, with the solar wings and all, not just the little compartments going from one end to the other. It was huge, and eventually I heard they got caught cheating. I don't know if that was true, if that was a rumor or not, but where they were opening up air vents and air handling machines and bringing in new air and all that. I don't know. But they had a hard time. They was, I think they were in there 2 years.
That was a great experiment and a humbling experiment, and it gives you a small thumbnail sketch as to how difficult it is to do complete recycling. And they had acres of material to do it with, and greenhouses and solar and all kinds of plants and whatever. To reestablish all of that on an interplanetary space station would be very, very difficult. There's a lot more to it than first meets the eye. What Mother Nature is doing to really recycle, we take it for granted. You dig into the specifics and you realize a hell of a lot of very complicated things are going on. Every shovel full of that dirt in your backyard contains all kinds of microbes, zillions of them, that are all working on all of those products that are being dropped from the birds and the leaves and the animals and whatever. Tremendous, complicated system, that whole ecosystem. And that's what's required to really maintain human beings for any significant length of time. John, after your discussion, I'm going to tell you what I've discovered about Wesley's environment and the distortion he's been experiencing. But I know you've got another subject to discuss. KC2, WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for 4 seconds, John.
We skipped Joe.
Yeah, we're going to come back to Joe.
KC2WGB. Good evening again, Dick, everyone on the net. Short comment on something Mel alluded to before. The Manhattan Project in Oak Ridge, believe it or not, cost less than the development and the procurement of the B-29. I don't know if you were familiar with that. And I believe Joe, RYY, had a comment on something Mel was speaking about. So why don't we let him go first?
Very fine, John. Okay, Joe, W-H-R-Y-Y, give us a little bit more audio than you did earlier. Go right ahead.
I'm not sure I was going to make a comment on, but you can kind of lift from our next one, because I will speak a little bit. That's basically about it, and I'm not going to say anything about that tonight.
Okay, you had your chance, Joe. Your audio is giving a little bit of a click once in a while, but we heard very well what you were saying. And so, you want to go on the list for next week? You're there. John, you've got it.
Thank you, Dick. KC2WGB. Dick, I think Wesley solved his problem today with that reception problem we were having. He's sounding very good tonight. I have a question. Wesley has paid several visits to my lab, and we've had some discussions here. And I just had one question on a little experiment I ran, and I hope you can... I'd like your expertise in this. It involved two magnets, two Horsham magnets. They weigh approximately 8 pounds each, and they're very strong magnets. I suspended them on vertical tracks so they would be directly above each other, aligned and repelling. Let me let it drop. And also, on these magnets, I put a veneer depth, a veneer height gauge, and as I press a magnet down, of course it repels, goes back up to the original mark. I've done it several hundred times, and it always does that. What I need an explanation on is the energy loss. The magnets are repelling each other. There's energy taking place. There's work being done, force and distance. Why can't the loss of the magnets be measured either with a magnetometer or a gaussometer, a gauss meter? Could you please explain what's going on as best as you could, please?
I'm not convinced that this is an area that I'm pretty strong at, John, but I'm going to make some guesses. What really is the magnetic field coming out of the magnet? It's one of those things where you can say, I can't define it, but I know it when I see it. There's a whole lot of experiential evidence you've got that you put a loop of wire nearby, you move the magnet by Faraday's law, I know how much voltage I'm going to get, how much current I'm going to get. If I know the magnetic field of the two magnets, and I know how much I've pushed them together, I know what force I'm going to get. And because that force is somewhat like a spring, that is to say, I'm applying a force through a distance, force times distance is energy, I can calculate how much force I'm going to get for each inch or each millimeter that I move the magnet, one closer to the other. I can calculate the force, I can calculate the distance, I can calculate the energy. When I let go of them, just like compressing a spring, I get essentially all that energy back, except for some eddy current losses, which again are quantifiable. And that's a function of what rate at which I'm moving them. Let me drop. So what is really going on in free space that causes those two opposing magnetic fields, the two norths coming together, the two souths coming together? Why do they repel when they're equal to each other, and why do they attract when they're opposite from each other? What's really going on at the microscopic level in space? I'm not convinced that that's known. At the microscopic level within the magnet itself, the domains and the way they line up so that the magnetic fields aid each other, that is somewhat understood. How you get a permanent magnet, how you get an electromagnet, that's somewhat understood. The coercivity and the paramagnetism and the all the kinds of magnetism of various materials, that's somewhat understood, again, from an experiential level. But just like we have very little understanding of what gravity really is, I'm not convinced we've got a whole lot of understanding as to what a magnetic field really is.
You ask to end?
Okay, I'm going to send over to Paul for a minute, but in a minute. We've got a lot of measurements. We know the way it acts. But why does it do that? I'm not sure that we really know. I wonder if NASA has some good reports on that one, Paul. WS2N, wait 4 seconds, KQRIW in the TechNet.
I remember discussing this probably maybe a year or two ago on the net. We talked about the magnetic fields, where they're getting their energy really from. All the electrons are constantly moving because of heat. And now, once all these things are all aligned properly, you know, the spin of the electrons and everything is properly aligned, you now have your magnetic field. So I think the question is, if these magnets are doing work, you know, how come there's no loss maybe in the magnet itself? You know, you can't measure a loss. I think the loss is constantly being replenished. There's a loss, but it's being replenished because these electrons keep moving. There's always going to be enough heat, or as long as there's enough heat to keep the electrons moving. If you bring it down to absolute zero, the electrons come to a grinding halt, I think then you will eventually lose your magnetic field. But I would think that I think we came to some kind of a consensus a year or two ago about this thing. Back to you.
I think we've got to be a little bit careful here. There's two kinds of movement of electrons going on. One kind of movement is the electrons that are in orbit, so to speak, around each nucleus of every atom. So you've got electrons that are moving around those protons and neutrons that are in the nucleus, and those electrons, there's a given number of them, which in most cases matches the number of protons that are in the nucleus, and they're in very specific shells of radius and moving in somewhat known manners. Those electrons combined with that nucleus gives you that particular element that you call hydrogen or oxygen or neodymium or iron or whatever. That's one kind of motion of those electrons, and I think those electrons are moving in a somewhat circular orbit around that nucleus, are a charge in motion which is creating a magnetic field, I believe. And when you magnetize a material, you're forcing those orbits, so to speak, to line up in such a way so that the individual elements, their magnetic fields, all come together and aid and give you a strong resultant magnetic field outside of the bar of the magnet itself. Let me drop. Now, those electrons moving around that nucleus are always there, even at cryogenic temperatures. if those electrons are not moving around that nucleus, you don't have oxygen, iron, neodymium, or whatever. That's got to stay constant. When you heat up a substance, in the case of a gas, the individual air molecules are moving at some amount of kinetic energy due to their velocity, 1/2 mv squared. We call that stored energy, we call that kinetic energy, we call it temperature. If I double the temperature of my gas that I'm studying in degrees Kelvin, absolute degrees, if I double the number of degrees, the average kinetic energy of all of those air molecules on average also doubles. That's what a thermometer measures, average kinetic energy of motion of the molecules and elements, but that's what it is. Well, most gaseous materials form double elements, like oxygen usually is O2 and hydrogen is H2 and so on when it's in the gaseous form. So I'm going to call it air molecules instead of air atoms. So the motion of the atom is what temperature is. The electrons going around the nucleus of each individual element, that's not temperature. Now, there are various ways that you can excite an element and force it temporarily to have those electrons jump to a higher orbit, and then they jump back down again, and that's part of the operation of a laser. That's different than temperature. It has some similarity, but it's different. So, and when it comes to a solid, when you heat up a solid, let me drop. Again, you're adding kinetic energy of velocity to the individual molecules of that solid. But in this case, they are not drifting around in free space like they do with a gas. They are vibrating in position. If I've got a crystal of some form, and all of those molecules are locked in position in order to form that crystal, it might be a sodium chloride crystal, for instance, and I heat it up, what am I really doing? I'm not moving those electrons from where they are. I'm making them vibrate in position more violently. That's what a thermometer measures for you. The average temperature of that salt crystal you've got is measuring the amount of motion of those molecules when they're vibrating in place, as if they're all held in their position with a spring, and they're able to vibrate against that spring. For the most part, you're not expanding the electrons themselves around those individual nucleuses. You're not changing those, because if you did, it's not salt anymore. That's my guess on that one. But now, when you take these individual domains of a magnetic material and line them all up because you've magnetized that material and you force those individual magnetic fields to align, you create this stronger field that you can easily sense on the outside of that bar magnet. But what is that magnetic field? We can't see it. For the most part, we can't taste it. We can't really touch it. We can sense it there with various kinds of instrumentation, a Hall effect device, a Faraday sensing loop. There's various ways that we can sense the presence of the magnetic field. And we know from our experience the way two magnets work together, the way they act. But what really is that field? I think there's a lot of theories. It's like sort of asking, what is real gravity? We've got a lot of experience to know the way gravity acts. But I'm
repeater, time out.
But I'm not sure that we really understand gravity. I'm not sure that we really understand magnetic field. But we do have predictability. If I know the strength of my two magnets, I know the distance at which I'm bringing them together, I know what force I'm going to get. That force to a distance is somewhat like compressing a spring. I know how much stored energy I've got because I pushed them together. And when I release them and they come flying back apart, I know how much energy I'm going to get back. And except for the eddy current losses, I'm going to get back almost the same energy that I put back in, very similar to compressing a spring. In case of compressing a spring, you do create a little bit of heat, and you've got a little bit of loss. But most of your energy in a reasonable spring comes back to you. In the same token, when I compress two magnets against their magnetic field, I think you get most of that compression energy back when you let them fly apart again. Maybe you see it a different way, John. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the tech man. Wait for 4 seconds.
Okay, Dick, just to explain how I came to ask the question, I used a solenoid coil, a mechanical advantage, a little lever, and I measured the amount of energy I needed to lift my magnet the same distance of the air gap between the two magnets. It was 3 inches, and I can measure that energy, and it's costing me money to lift this because of the energy, but yet the magnets can do it, and the magnets don't change in temperature either, expending this energy or this effect, whatever it is. So that's what led me to ask the question, what is happening? And I appreciate your effort in trying to describe it. I know we don't know exactly, but I don't, if it was vibrating molecules, there would be heat being generated in the magnets. There is no heat that I can measure. I've got some pretty sophisticated temperature equipment. So that's the only thing, and I appreciate your effort to explain it. If anybody else on the web wants to join in there, do so. But I thank you again, Dick.
Comment.
A comment recognized. When you use an electromagnet, your electromagnet has mediocre material. I'm being a little bit severe here, John. Your magnet, your electromagnet has got a coil of wire around a magnetic bar of some kind, and that coil of wire has resistance. And as you pour current through that coil of wire, by I squared R, you're losing energy in that coil. And now you and I know why the large collider in Switzerland is using superconducting magnets, because they have to put tremendous amounts of current to get the magnetic field that they desire, and they would be getting an amount of loss that their local power company could not support if those magnets were not superconducting magnets. And by the same token, in theory, you could make your coil of your electromagnet out of a superconducting wire. And if you did that, other than the amount of energy you would be putting into the magnet to begin with because of its inductance, and as you put current into there, 1/2 LI squared, you would be storing a certain amount of energy into the inductive magnetic field of your electromagnet. And as long as you're using materials that don't have a lot of eddy current losses, when you remove the current from your superconducting electromagnet, that stored energy in the inductance of that coil of wire would all come back to you as an inductive kickback. So in that particular case, if you use the right material, a superconducting magnet, you would be making an investment to put energy in it to create the magnetic field. But in theory, you would get that all back again when you remove the source of that current. So there is conservation of energy here of an ideal electromagnet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
You're using that technique to create the magnetic field that allows you to do the lifting. And the energy that's dissipated during the lifting process is something that you've supplied by the current you put into the magnet. And once the lift has been accomplished and the magnets come together, your permanent magnet and your electromagnet come together, you have a brand new inductance of that combination. And now, in theory, you're going to get a greater amount of 1/2 LI squared energy back out of that electromagnet when you remove the current source from it. So in the overall picture, I see a process by which it is possible to conserve, to have a conservation of energy in that whole system if you are able to use materials that are ideal enough. So I'm not convinced there's any real loss or gain in what you've described so far. Wesley, in 2XJN, wait 4 seconds, K2RIW in the tech man.
Correction, Dick, please, on the topic.
Okay, John and Paul in that order. John first.
Dick, maybe I didn't describe correctly what I did. I was only using one horseshoe magnet. I was using the solenoid through a lever just to lift it, not measuring the lift energy, just the hold energy above. So that energy that it took to hold it up has to be sort of similar to what the two magnets were using
the same amount of energy to keep that space apart, of course divided by two because of the two magnets. That's how I did that experiment. And I was just saying that the same effort to hold it up with my device had to be the same energy, basically, that the two magnets were dissipating. And that's what I was saying. The magnets do not generate any heat, but yet they keep the gap standard. That was my arrangement.
Yeah, I think I almost see that. Let's see what Paul's going to say. You got it, Paul.
Okay, I had a question based on the topic of the what magnetic power. Where does this come from? I remember the discussion, and it went something like, if I take my permanent magnet and attach it to my metal workbench, and I come back a year later, or 2 years later, or 20 years later, or maybe even 100 years later, I could disconnect that magnet, and it's still strong as could be. And what was the reason why it was so strong? And I believe we said it was the electrons going around all the atoms, and you know, as long as they keep going around, and you know, everything stays in line. That's the reason that thing still has all that power all those years later. So I guess we're getting into physics, but then what keeps the electrons going? I mean, if all heat stopped, I would think the electrons would eventually separate from the nucleus. And then you wouldn't, not only would you not have magnetism, yeah, you wouldn't have the material anymore. But isn't it regular heat that's keeping these electrons going, right? And that's where I got the, you know, that's how I got to where we got tonight. Back to you.
So KC2 QIQ with a comment here.
Glenn recognized, you're going to be right after Wesley. No, I don't agree, Paul. It is not the heat that's keeping the electrons going. Those electrons are moving around that nucleus of each individual atom, and that's what the atom is. The atom is some number of protons and neutrons in the nucleus, and an electron, or some number of electrons, equal number to the protons in general, flying around that nucleus. Those electrons think that they are in a perfect vacuum. There is no loss mechanism for those electrons. In general, if I've got a chunk of iron, and I measure the velocity of those electrons and their energy and whatever, a zillion years later, as long as that iron didn't rust and didn't change in some way, those electrons are doing the exact same things they did. If they didn't, I don't have iron. If I could cryogenically cool those iron molecules, and if those electrons stopped moving by some mechanism around those nucleuses, then I've got a bunch of powder in the bottom of that chamber, I don't have iron anymore. In order for there to be iron, and once I cryogenically cool material, in general, I've got the same material. It's just colder. You don't suddenly crumble iron just because you've cryogenically cooled it. I can cool it within a micro degree of absolute zero. They've done that already. Within a micro degree or so of absolute zero. And although the vibration of the molecules within their crystal lattice becomes a very small amount of vibration, the individual electrons around those individual nucleuses did not change. There is no energy dissipation mechanism for them to do that. If you did, you're transmuting those... If you did, you're transmuting that element into something else. I'd like to be able to convert lead into gold by changing the number of protons in each nucleus and the number of electrons going around it. As you now know, that's an extremely difficult process to change one element into another element. Very, very difficult. Those elements in general are extremely stable, and even cryogenically cooled, they keep their stability, the individual elements. So temperature is the average kinetic energy of the total element or the total molecule. By vibrating in space, in their locked-in position in the lattice. It isn't a change in the energy of the individual electrons around that nucleus. That's an entirely different process of exciting that atom, which, as I said before, is something you do in the case of a laser when you're charging up that lacing material. But in general, just plain temperature doesn't do that. And by the way, when you want to excite those electrons, you've got to do it with an extremely specific amount of energy, otherwise they'll ignore you. You put in too little or too much, they will not do it. You've got to put in a precise amount of energy in order to make one of those electrons hop to the next higher orbit. And in general, he won't stay there. In general, he won't stay there. He jumps right back down again and gives off a very specific wavelength and amount of energy when he does it. And that's the exact amount of energy you put in when you excited that molecule. N2XJM, wait for 4 seconds, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, N2XJM. Actually, I disagree with you, digging one point, because you said I don't see any gain. Of course, you keep forgetting one factor. When you have a two vertical thyroid magnets with a hole inside and a plastic rod keeping them in vertical, so they cannot slide, then if there is a one pulse, which is one push with your finger on the top magnet, then the energy recovers. Well, if we're dealing with the potential energy that is actually turning into kinetic energy and that the work is being done, then there is a gain, because the magnet on the top returns with the energy of work. So we're talking about over-unity. This is the real proof of the over-unity. That's the free energy device that I'm working on it. Now, let me go back to the scalar waves. Now, we stated, based on the evidence at least, of the factors represented by the German scientist from the German university, let me drop. These scalar waves are geostationary. That means you have a plenty of scalar waves, like a light bulb, and they are actually, every one of these light bulbs has its own power supply. So what is everywhere present is a magnetic field. Okay, so if we compare the scalar waves to the magnets, actually, or set of magnets, vertically, we may say that each one of them is able to recover the energy. So then, if the initial energy of the signal or information is being triggered, like in that video with receiver and the transmitter, then each one of the scalar waves use its own energy source to actually activate another scalar wave. That's why the result of that was that in Faraday cage, actually the receiver was able to receive the scalar waves. Let me go further from that. If we say that we have the emptiness of the empty space, but in fact it's not empty, I would say ocean of great energy. And there was a guy in the army, American army, Mr. Burton, who actually named this ocean of energy time domain. Energy out of time might seem like a Star Trek, so people may laugh. So let's go further with that. We live in three-dimensional world. With physics, we call it three space. But there is also the fourth space, which is actually the fourth dimension, and the fourth dimension is the time. So if we say that we have, and this is the Russian approach, that we have a compressed energy with time, and the time is speed of light, let's say, it's the time as well, so then if this energy, which is compressed by exactly the same factor by which matter is considered compressed energy, the speed of light is squared. Let me go further. find actually the new companion to famous E equals MC square, which is now paired with the ETC, the double 2, which actually T stands for delta T, or change of time. So then we have E equals EMC squared and E equals delta TC squared. So, we might say that it is an atomic bomb released the compressed energy in matter. So we can now unleash, I believe, the tremendous energy that is compressed into time itself. It is completely new meaning to the term time bomb. Russians have made interesting experiment, and it was in the 50s. Actually, 1957, they started, they finished up the project in 1958. I was born in 1956. So, Soviet has progressed to the point of giant color waves. Also, before I go further, our organism uses color waves as well. There was an incident in Ural, which exploded near the atomic waste devastating area, and color waves were actually used. There was another program that was using the color waves, and this structure is still being seen from the satellite, enormous antennas with the exactly the kind of bulbs at the end on it, like you saw in the video, and the one that is used in the Tesla coils or Van de Graaff coils. And the Soviet actually found that application of the scalar waves and magnetic fields would be the solution to energy crisis or energy domination, powerful weapons, cure for the disease, and mind control of the mass scale as the scalar waves are being utilized by our body. So, if we cannot explain the phenomenon of two magnets repelling themselves and recovering 100%, that is the biggest proof of existence of scalar waves recovering themselves. And at that point, we say that we are approaching a new area of understanding physics. Back to you, Dick, and to Asia.
I've got a number of comments on all of the above. Before I get into that, let me pick up Glenn first. KC2QIQ, K2LIW. Wait a few seconds. Go ahead, Doc Glenn.
Actually, Dick, I just wanted to make a couple of quick things. When I was listening to Paul's question earlier, you know, he was asking about, you know, the magnetic field and why doesn't the magnetic field, lose energy. And I think I just wanted to point out to Paul, and I mean, I know you kind of hit on it in a roundabout way, but basically what's happening is the magnetic field around a magnet, a physical permanent magnet, is not kinetic energy, it's potential. It's a field, but it's just sitting there. So no real work is being done. There's no temperature rise. There's no electrical currents flowing. It's just a field sitting around a material. And basically the same thing could be said for electrical dipoles in chemical makeups. In other words, you can have atoms sitting, you know, side by side that can make a voltage dipole. And it will sit there. And as long as no current is flowing, no real kinetic work is being done. And it's sitting in it. The energy is sitting there in a potential state. Let me let it drop for a second.
Until one pulse.
And basically, as long as nothing is moving and that material sits there, there's no real reason for the energy to decay unless, like you said, like the material itself starts falling apart. So the alignment of that material, as long as it stays there, nothing interferes with that field. Basically, that field can stay there, essentially as long as the half-life of the material exists. So for a very, very long time without anything disturbing it. Also, I think one other thing, Leslie, I was listening to what you were saying about time and square wave and power. But there's something you have to keep in mind here, too. Every time you deal with duty cycles and power, If you take power and you create power in a certain period of time and then you